part of our research team, whilst we fill the vacancies, is seated at the back there next to Ms. Shabalala. We welcome him. Colleagues, we're meeting with the State Security Agency Minister and your team. Welcome. We had requested that we have a meeting for the progress on the vetting, particularly in the supply chain sector, in preparation of our work when we obviously going to be starting with the hearings, as the AG has released the audit outcomes. colleagues, as you know, the State Security Agency ordinarily does its reporting to Parliament in camera, but we have advised the department that here the operative word in our name is public, and so we generally take a dim view on closed sessions. The Minister has understood our dimension and her team, and they will give us a report on where they are. So I would request that we also respect that particular aspect, but without being overbearing about it. But let's understand that as we try and do our work. So that is the situation. Minister, as I've said, we're going to be starting with our hearings into the audit outcomes. We've already started with municipalities. And so the fundamental challenges for us, supply chain seems to have become a runaway train. There is very little oversight and accountability, and our predicament here is that we come in at the tail end of the audit cycle. And so we really need to build up the in-year capacities and capabilities. There's too many public servants doing business with the state. There's too much fronting, and corruption for the maladministration seem to be a new norm. We had the Fifth Parliament met with the State Security Agency in December 2017 with the then Minister and the then DG. We had parted with an agreement that we would fast-track this process of vetting, which, as far as we are concerned, is moving at a snail's pace. We understand, of course, that there have been changes politically and administratively, and that there have been also reports which propose changes to how things are going to be run in the State Security Agency and so on. So from our side, it is, for the purposes of the Sixth Parliament, a preliminary meeting to meet and to understand where you are, and for us to convey our expectations. And I must highlight at the outset that we need to move with the necessary speed. We understand that there is resistance, of course, in certain quarters, that people generally don't like being vetted, but it's not a matter of whether you like it or not. It's a matter of due process, and where we have to enforce it, we will do so. So that is part of the work that we need to do. So by the time this new committee starts, we will be in full swing, having made sure that the foundations are solidified. We have met with the anti-corruption task team, which is one of your partners, and we will continue having those engagements. So this being the first meeting, I would like members to introduce themselves, and then the minister and your team will introduce themselves, and then when they are done with those introductions, the minister will immediately go into the presentation. So Ngizoqala KwaZulu-Natal, Mazambane.
At least you can see the you honor the age of the delegates to your committee. is there anyone who doesn't know? Mr. Chairman, my name is Alf Lees, member of the committee, and of course resident in KwaZulu-Natal, and I haven't left and absconded to another province.
And Clafel. I think you've got the wrong mic, Mama.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning all. My name is Thandiswa Makgau from Eastern Cape. Thank you.
Molweni Tombovio Mende, member of the committee.
Good morning, name is Sakumzi Somna, the member of the committee.
Good morning, Chair. I'm the Musisi Sinokuzola Dolashe, member of SCOPA.
I'm Beauty Zibula, the member of the SCOPA.
Right, I'm Mkule Wotlengwa. I chair the committee. Minister, over to you.
Ngiyabonga kakhulu Sihlalo. Igama lami ngu-Ayanda Mokodlodlo, uMinister we-State Security.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Sipho Prosa, State Security.
I'm Makodi Mokope, Director, Domestic Branch, SSA.
Right. I see there are people behind you, Minister. We've got a keen interest to know who they are as well. Because some of them may be the ones we deal with on a daily basis when you're not around.
Morning, Chairperson. I'm Seth Ramrongo from SSA.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Ophelia Matabuche from SSA.
Morning. I'm Chester Dau from SSA.
Morning, Chairperson. It's Nomsa Lamini from the Ministry of State Security.
All right. All right. Colleagues, we all fine? All right. Minister, new team, over to you.
Could I first start by apologizing for having the documents brought in late and that we did not have copies available. I think for our part, we were not sure whether to make copies available or not, but in looking at what is contained in the presentation, there's nothing really top secret about what we're going to be presenting. But I'd first like, Chairperson, to start by reading to you what is in the background of the discussion document, which is a CAB memo of 2006, which is an introduction of state of national vetting strategy for South Africa to enhance government's vetting capacity on national, provincial, and local government levels, including parastatals and other statutory organs of state. On the background, we have there that government officials are continuously at risk of becoming the targets of acts of espionage, sabotage, subversion, corruption, bribery, blackmail, and a range of other criminal and unconstitutional activities. This has added negative impact of compromising government service delivery. It is imperative that government be sanitized from employees that harm its security and service delivery objectives. Parliament instructed the National Intelligence Agency to formulate a strategy, a national vetting strategy for South Africa to overcome the problems facing security screening and vetting in South Africa. This strategy was to address the screening and vetting needs of government, national, provincial, local, and other organs of state. Simultaneously, the IGI, which is the Inspector General, investigated the vetting process in South Africa. The NIA task team incorporated these findings and benchmarked it with international practice to formulate a new strategy. The investigation into vetting as an international practice revealed that most countries struggle with vetting. Those countries that solved the problem came up with a holistic counterintelligence approach, whereby all stakeholders, including vetting clients, became involved in the vetting process. This implies that clients become involved in basic screening at pre-employment stage, and the intelligence community assists with in-depth vetting, investigating once access to classified information is required. As we give the presentation, you will understand why I had to give you the background of a strategy that was approved by Cabinet in 2006 and sadly never implemented. If we go to page 2 of the document, we take you through the CAB memo itself, introduction on that. And the objective set out in the CAP memo was that a chief directorate external vetting must be established within the National Intelligence Agency, and that was achieved. That all organs of state were to be capacitated with personnel suitability checks, and this was not achieved. That we were to establish a vetting field work unit at 17 identified organs of state, and 23 of the VFUs were established. The rollout of the security vetting information system to organs of state with vetting field work units, including the SAPS and the SANDF, and certain departments were also identified for implementation. To make amendments to the National Strategic Intelligence Act of 1994 for the establishment of these units, and that was achieved. The establishment of the National Intelligence Agency Fingerprint Unit at the SAPS Criminal Record Center, and this was not achieved. In 2012, the President of the Republic of South Africa, Honorable J.G. Zuma, said in his, and reiterated, and also reiterated by the Minister of Intelligence, Minister Gcwele, that all public servants within supply chain management must be vetted as indicative of government's commitment to the fight against corruption. That a project on the vetting of supply chain management personnel commenced in February 2014. The project only managed to achieve security clearances of 48% of the submitted requests. However, as corruption continued, it was then realized that vetting of SCM did not yield the required results in eliminating corruption. Therefore, the overall value chain needed to be reviewed. And part of the reason why we were a little bit late is because I had then asked that the decision value chain should be developed so that we see where decisions start and where they end with regards to procurement. That supply chain management is only a fraction of what goes on in the decision matrix. The identification and of the need for procurement starts at a different level. It's driven by the strategic objectives of eight departments, meaning that the minister who has the responsibility to establish the strategic plan of the department is a key player in determining ultimately what it is that needs to go into the procurement of matters that will ensure the implementation of the strategic objectives of a department. Then you have the key role players, which basically, and it would be the ministers, it would be the HODs, and it would be the boards as accounting authorities in your SOEs. And the key role players would be the line function personnel, your boards, the directors, and the executives of departments or state-owned entities. Then you have the development of the required specifications for the items to be procured. Again, it's the line function managers, but that decision starts at a much lower level than the HOD before it even goes to supply chain management. So if you are looking at trying to curb corruption and bribery and all sorts of malfeasance, you would then have to start at a level lower than that of the supply chain management personnel, because the decision emanates or the genesis of the decision is at a different place altogether. Then the execution of the procurement government processes, that is the request for the authorization, the approvals for the procurement of the identified goods and services, and the role players there would be your bid adjudication committee. It is only after all of this has been exhausted that the supply chain management people come in. When the decisions have already been taken, they execute the implementation of those decisions that would have been taken. So in a sense, we are saying that let us not only concentrate on supply chain management, but let's look at the whole decision value chain to determine and to determine where decisions lie and where they emanate and what could happen in between. The causes of the backlog would be the lack of human capacity, the dependency on other departments with regards to databases, like for instance, your criminal record center, your SAPS fingerprint center. We would need information from the data, access to the database of SARS, and the list is endless. the non-compliance and cooperation of subjects and references where those subjects do not want to give all of the information that is required for us to complete the loop of vetting. The overclassification of clearance levels by security managers, where you find that a person doesn't actually need secret, top secret clearance, but confidential would suffice, but sometimes we insist on a top secret clearance when it is actually not needed. So it then prolongs the process, because the documentation that would be required is heaps and heaps of documentation, when in actual fact you would not need as much as you would be asking for if your classification is not correct. The non-inclusion of required documents by the subject, which speaks to the same matter. We then go to the challenges in the supply chain management project. That for state security, vetting is an unfunded mandate. And I'm not sure if SCOPA is alive to that. We do not get money to do this. Poor attendance to security managers fora by security managers. Excuse the word forum, it's supposed to be fora. Non-compliance by security managers to SSA requirements for vetting. Lack of knowledge of government employees and those of state-owned entities regarding why they need to be vetted. Sometimes this vetting is used to get rid of people. Sometimes it is used as a labor relations tool to discipline people. So we want vetting to be used for the correct purposes for which it was initially intended. Government employees and those of SOEs, including most security managers, do not understand the process of vetting. Resistance by government employees and those of SOEs to undergo vetting. Interference of unions. Lack of capacity and resources at SSA, lack of compliance monitoring by executives from external departments and also including your SOEs, lack of regulations to enforce compliance. The interventions we propose, Slalo, to eliminate the backlog are as follows: that state security and the police engage on and implement the 2006 cabinet memo, and that the minister responsible must sign the national vetting strategy office. The approval and implementation of the integrated national vetting strategy, and the estimated date for this is March 2020, the end of the financial year, basically. The fast tracking of the e-vetting solution, which is the 30th of September 2020, which is the pilot phase. To collaborate with organs of state, the National School of Government, as one of them for purposes of ensuring that people go on refresher courses, but also ensuring that some of these awareness programs that we're wanting to introduce are compulsory and are part of the induction of all employees joining the state. Review the management information security standards and fast track the approval of vetting regulations. Both of these. We are putting a deadline of 30th September 2020, which you can hold us to. The recommendations would be that the implementation of the CAB memo through the facilitation of the provisioning of access to required databases, meaning that we should be signing MOUs, but also the CAB memo is very specific on what each department needs to do to collaborate with the other to ensure that this is done. To ensure ownership and accountability by the accounting officers, and I think this is where we would want SCOPA to also assist us with, that it becomes one of those areas of competency that goes into a performance agreement of the HODs to ensure that every staff member that is due for vetting must have gone through vetting, including those people that have been appointed pending the outcome of the vetting, that they should be vetted within a year, as is also stipulated. What that would mean, Slalo, is that our talent search processes should change. Where we advertise for positions, we need to make it very clear in the advert that for this particular position, a particular level of security clearance is required. And when that person gets their letter of employment, in that letter it should be clearly stipulated that that individual should have undergone the security clearance at the level at which was stipulated in the job advert, failing which, if they do not, certain steps should be taken, because the appointment of that individual must hinge on the final outcome, which is the vetting clearance. Provisioning of funding for conducting vetting activities, including the implementation of ICT solution to automating vetting processes, MOU between the Intelligence Academy to ensure that security awareness is one of the compulsory training modules. That is the MOU between the National School of Government and the Intelligence Academy. But also when it comes to the provisioning of funding for conducting vetting activities, that we would also want departments to pay for the service, because it is an unfunded mandate. The difficulty with that would have to be dealt with so that we ensure that we're able to do the work within the budget that is available. So departments must start budgeting for that as well. Myth and vetting regulations are to be approved to ensure compliance, vetting to be paid for by clients, as I said earlier on, change in employment conditions to reflect vetting as compulsory, and the last one is the engagement with unions to give clarity on vetting mandate. So it's an awareness issue as well. Thank you very much, Chair.
All right, thank you very much, Minister. I think colleagues, well, there it is, the process which has been, the background which has been given. I will now hand over to you, colleagues, where there are questions, and then we can tie this one down. Right, Honorable Somia. Honorable Mente, Honorable Lees. Right, let's take maybe those three, and then what? Honorable Sam, you've got the floor.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let's appreciate the presentation by the Minister. The presentation indicates a bit of a grim picture of what is happening with the vetting system. Though there is the existence of an instrument in as far as the cabinet memo is concerned for such to be done. It's a very disappointing situation. As you would know, Chair, that through our own oversight, we've had very glaring situation in the biggest of the SOEs in terms of the funding received to from the state. As an example, ESCOM, wherein a number of officials are either doing a business with that company, and they succeed in doing so, and there's absolutely no some kind of intention of stopping that kind of an occurrence, and this kind of instrument could be a very useful instrument. I hear the minister is saying, yes, the decision value chain is broader than just supply chain. For me, it looks like, yes, that's the case, but broadening that kind of a scenario when it comes to a situation where she tells us that there's no capacity to pull with a vetting process in that very little and minute area, then in an extended fashion, how are they going to be able to succeed in doing so? So for me, the starting point is that they must show commitment to do so in the little space that they have been given. And through that little space that they have been given, they could expand into the areas of the side in terms of that a value chain. There's an area which has indicated on the classification of such levels. It might as well be necessary that classification of levels could go with defined jobs within the entire service, so that it should be known that indeed you would need these kind of categories of a classified vetting, you see, authority in the various levels of decision making going forward. So that description must be made. The third area which relate to the purpose, I fully agree with the first at times. There are some consequences which are a bit dire in as far as making use of such instruments of wanting to get rid of individuals, and that is not getting up quite well in terms of the depth of such a perpetual outlook of the vetting process itself. So the advert must then carry that insistence in agreeing with the recommendations that are put forward around that aspect. But there is the last point which I would want to deal with. There is an indication that there's going to be a fast tracking of the e-vetting solution. And if there is fast tracking of e-vetting solution, where would that be based? Would that be somewhat decentralized units, or would it be carried in the same manner? I'm asking that question because even the starting point of appointment is at the level of the institution that is calls for an advert. So there are some limited outlook of the information which such institutions ought to require, and through the availability of such, they would know then which angle to take, and then the e-vetting system would carry on in terms of giving rather a red line or a green light in as far as such appointment is being made. And the AG, in terms of the accountability, ought to be taken through to insist that if a call has been made for a position to be vetted, if that does not happen, it should as well be a call for insistence in as far as less accountability for such occurrence. And there could be some kind of citing of such in terms of the lack of or accountability of such officers who are responsible for such a vetting process. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Right, Honourable Mente. So what we'll do, we'll take three members for now, and then we will give an opportunity for responses, which are not really having a hearing. Right, Honourable Mente.
Thank you, Chair. Now, Chairperson, thank you, Minister, for the highlight on the vetting. Firstly, you're highlighting the fact that your office is a shortage in terms of a human resource. I know that you have your separate portfolio committee that you account to in terms of asking for budgets and all that. But I am keen to know if that has been forwarded and has it been accepted or rejected by the committee, so that we are all members of parliament and we all have a common interest. Therefore, we cannot have a simple thing as a human resource being a stumbling block in ensuring that corruption is rooted out in our country. Would like to know the status of that. And secondly, when we have the SCOPA mandate, is that we need to deal with how the public funds, in fact, to police the public funds. And in doing so, we find, in most cases, we'll find officials that come here
and say, no, we were not vetted. We have applied, the security state agency is, we are waiting, and all sorts of excuses. Is your office then in a position to avail a member whenever the SCOPA committee is in need of someone in your office to come and account in SCOPA so that we deal with, we actually separate the criminals that come here and lie and use your office as an excuse that, no, you have, we have been waiting, we couldn't appoint, we ended up appointing wrong people we didn't know. They were not vetted because of your office. I know that as far back as 2014, SCOPA dealt with the department in terms of what you are promising to have finalized very soon, in particular the regulation. Because it still baffles my mind how the regulations to enforce that every member who is being appointed in a public service, irrespective of they are going to be in an environment of supply chain or not, the fact that you are going to take a senior level, that you are going to be taking decisions, you should be vetted. It doesn't matter whether you are going to be dealing with rents and cents or procurement. I can take a police station, for instance. A station commander, most of the time, doesn't sit with SCM. The supply chain head is separate. But who gives an instruction that there must be 10 vans procured for the police station? A station commander. Therefore, we cannot say as a person who's not directly linked to the rents and cents must not be vetted. So I am not sure, and according to Chapter 10, the Section 1951, it emphasizes on ethics and integrity of who comes into the service, into the public service. Therefore, I do not understand how come the regulations are that far. I don't know if ever you can at least give us an indication of how far are the regulations to enforce that everyone who comes into the public service must be vetted. I hear that you are proposing that it must extend to everyone else who takes the decision before that, but then if that is not regulated, we'll still face a brick wall where it can be a decision that people must be vetted, and they will still go and say, there's no law that binds me to be vetted. Can we have that tied down at least? The last thing I would like to know is do you have a direct relationship with SAPS and the PSC? Because I should think they are the two departments that should be assisting you, and you should in your office have a direct link, which is a person who works with them on a daily basis, who is directly involved in SAPS fingerprint unit to fast track whatever, do follow-ups and submissions, as well as the PSC in terms of their report, because they sit with the disclosure framework report, and every year members of the public service, the ones that are in management, they disclose. So from that disclosure, do we have someone who goes through them, picks up all the people that haven't done what they were supposed to do, which did not comply with the law in terms of being vetted, didn't disclose their relationships with the state and the interest they have with having business, or the business that they had before they come into the service? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Liz.
Mr. Chairman, Honourable Mente has touched on one of the things I want to say is, because this seems to be based on a cabinet memo, not on an act of parliament. What are the parameters under which you're working? Because, I mean, who is supposed to be vetted? Who isn't supposed to be vetted? you can't issue regulations unless there's an act under which to issue regulations, and I'm not sure, I don't know. I mean, can you tell me on what basis? Because if you're also wanting extra resources and extra money, well, who gave you the authority to do these functions if not Parliament? Because Parliament allocates the money. So I'm just a bit lost about how this whole thing works, and so I'd appreciate it if you have patience with me and just explain, because what does vetting mean in a sense? I mean, I haven't paid my parking ticket from last year. Does that, would you then recommend that I don't get the job, kind of thing? It's to the ordinary man in the street, and I've classified myself as that, this whole thing is just a lot of unknowns about how it's got to work. For instance, access to the records of SARS. On what basis would you have an MOU with SARS? Other than the normal security legislation, as opposed to this vetting kind of function, which I'm not sure where it falls into legislation. And I'm not sure how this stops corruption, quite honestly. You're obviously not going to give people jobs who are known to have or fail the vetting, whatever fail the vetting means. But none of the suppliers are going to be vetted. And we know that corruption involves both state officials and suppliers. So I'm not sure at the end of the day how this is working or is going to work, or whether it's simply an exercise to try and say, look, we know there's a problem, we're trying to do something. Getting back to the budget, how much is it going to cost? If the whole job were done properly, as you see what properly is, I'm not sure I understand what properly means, what would it cost? And where would we get that money from? How has National Treasury been involved in this? Because even if it's paid for by the client departments, it all has to come out of the National Revenue Fund. So, what is the basis on which you're doing the vetting? Is it simply a cabinet memo, or is there some sort of legislative authority? And exactly, not exactly, but give us some idea of what it means to pass a vetting or fail a vetting. When we're talking about supply chain, we're not talking about people sitting on your committee who have to go through a huge vetting process. We're simply talking about the average supply chain official. What does it really mean to be fail the vetting or pass the vetting? And how much would it cost if it were to be fully implemented as you understand the word fully?
All right, thank you very much. So can we get responses to that first set of interactive questions, and then we'll proceed from there. Colleagues, I'll take another round after that.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would maybe let me start with the first questions that were raised by the Honourable Member there. The issues of the review.
Master, can you just send over the mic? Yeah.
All right. Oh, okay. I'm not used to this mic. The issue of the SOEs. And that was raised by Honourable Member there, is that yes, it's true that some in the sectors that we vet don't fully comply with the outcomes of vetting. Even if you would say in a clearance outcome, this person is not supposed to be getting top secret clearance because of the following reasons. They still go ahead and employ such people. the case in point would have been the, if I may make an example, the issue of post office in Cape Town, wherein we gave a an indication through screening that this particular individual had a criminal record. But our view was put aside. They then employed their own internal processes wherein that person was employed by post office. In other instances, yes, in other instances, poor student lost their life. In other instances, senior people in government, they don't want to be vetted. In other areas, state-owned entities, they don't want to be vetted. We are currently doing work at, if Minister allows me, ESCOM. We are sitting with a list of 121 senior people who needs to be vetted so that we can assist government to turn things around at ESCOM to reduce the levels of corruption.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Just 1 second. I think let's tie this down very nicely because the post office matter raises a red flag in my mind. If you can just... So you had screened, or in one way or the other, you picked up something.
Yes.
And you advised the post office of this, and they still carried on full steam ahead, bypassing or ignoring or negating your process and in affected their own process. So was there some process it was that you had undertaken insofar as that was concerned? Is this just part of day-to-day work that you do? Because I'm trying to separate the screening and the vetting, because we were focused on SCM, but you've raised another dimension, which I think helps us understand exactly what you do. I'm not wanting to get into the merits and demerits of your process. That's that. I'm just trying at very high level. As part of your day-to-day, this was flagged. Because it would speak to another issue, colleagues, which we won't deal with today, but that we'll have to raise with the various other committees insofar as whether there's compliance with what SCA tells you about employees. It's another issue for us that we need to look at.
Yes.
Chairperson, I think this is what the crux of this vetting process actually boils down to. It's a personnel suitability check. And it goes beyond just corruption or any other thing. And the post office one in the case is gone. And we can talk about quite a number of others. We do this so that we protect even the employees of government. We protect the general public. So it goes just beyond the supply chain management issue and corruption issues. And the response to your question as well would be no, it's not just about corruption. It is about everything that we would want to see an employee of government relying on in terms of being a suitable person for employment in government. It's not based on the CAB memo. The CAB memo was just about the strategy for vetting. That's all that it was. The pieces of legislation that gives rise to this thing of vetting. So we do have quite a number, and I mean, that's precisely the reason why we are saying we do not only want to look at those matters that relate only to what SCOPA could be interested in. There's many other issues, and the UNN person becomes a case in point. But for purposes of, and that's why I asked the office, and that's why they were late, that's why I said prepare a decision grid so that people understand where these decisions come from. And Ms. Mente came up with a very good example of where decisions emanate from, the genesis of decisions and their implementation. Their implementation is the supply chain management. But I can decide at the level at which the decision is initially taken, the scope, the pace, and the size of a contract on anything. I can decide that. That corruption would have started with me. It would not have started with the person at supply chain management. So if SCOPA says to us, do supply chain management, then they need to say, supply chain management vetting, then they need to say to us, what is the reason for that? What do you want to achieve by dealing only with the supply management area? Because the decisions, the scope, the size, and the pace of any contract or any procurement that is needed in a department doesn't emanate from supply chain management. Supply chain management manage that process of supply chain, and that's all they do. Can corruption happen at that level? Of course it can, but the genesis of the decision is where it is most important, rather than supply chain management. If SCOPA says to us, all that you're interested in is just supply chain management, and you advise us on what the reason behind that is, we will understand and only confine ourselves to that supply chain management. But I think it would be very foolhardy if we sit as parliamentarians and only want to confine ourselves to a small portion of what might affect the economy of our country, that might affect the safety and security of our people, that might affect the reputation of our country. So the scope and size for me is the most important thing, including the pace at which we think.
I just wanted to tie it down on that one. But I think the explanations have helped. They have. I'll pass it back to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was still talking also on the issue of ESCOM, that there is reluctance, maybe refusal by the executive to be vetted. Out of 121, we only received 21. Cooperation, limited as it were. Now, despite several attempts to push that we want to cover the space, because this is a project we've been tasked with, the task to vet them in order to help government reduce the levels of corruption and turn things around the issues of this call, that is not moving with the pace that we would require to do our work. I'm sure this will be handled through the executive, so that at least some pressure would be exerted on those who must comply and cooperate with the team. There was an issue of where do we locate E-Vetting. E-Vetting will be located within SSA at the center. How we work is that we have a center, but we have field units in departments. So those field units would be having a window to log in the files that they would have done, because the clearance is the mandate of SSA, is us who then make a decision in terms of evaluating what is in the file and arrive at a particular conclusion. If it's top secret clearance, it would mean you must have more referees, and you must also be subjected to polygraph, so that we are able to detect any other thing that would have been missed through investigation. If it's secret, still poly would be a necessity to undergo, only if there is something that we picked up in the process of investigation. With confidential, it's just normal screening, and then that can be fast-tracked to reduce the levels of backlog. That is what we are actually doing in terms of this process.
On the shortage of HR personnel, we, through our budget vote process, we did raise the issue with the ad hoc committee that was established, the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. There isn't such a committee in existence as yet, but when we prepared for our budget vote, we did raise and flag some of these things with them. Should vetting be compulsory at all levels of decision rights? I agree with that. It should be. Do we have a direct relationship with staffs in the Public Service Commission? We do have a relationship, but all relationships can still be strengthened. More so where we are experiencing problems, as we have said, where we have to access particular databases and information, it becomes a little difficult from time to time. And we were thinking that maybe if we tie them down to an MOU, but also procure our own system so that we're not entirely dependent on them, that would help as well. I've already responded to the one about whether this is based on a cabinet memo. The cabinet memo has got nothing to do with anything except that it was the approval of a national vetting strategy that is based on some legislation.
Wait, colleagues, right, let us take, Liz and then Mente, follow-ups, and then...
Mr. Chairman, just quickly, okay, I understand what it's based on, but does that define whether who gets vetted? In other words, the point made there that Eskom officials are just refusing. Surely if there's a law, you can put them in jail.
Yeah. That's exactly the issue. Honourable Mente.
Minister, now we in the Sifonayo we want to get the right people and the wrong people like Mazamba Nasho in jail. Now, in the recourse and the law that governs this whole vetting process. What's the recourse, for instance, in the case of, let's take the post office. A post office decides otherwise in its own platform. Yet, your office, in terms of governing the right people that should undertake certain duties of public service, you said no. Isn't there a recourse? Because we can't have a department that acts contrary to what you are saying. You are top security guards of the country. You say this is a criminal, it must not come and serve our people. This person should actually belong elsewhere. But then a department in South Africa acts contrary to that. Isn't there a recourse? Isn't there an enforcement of a law that no, you are wrong. We either arrest you as a panel, as a panel that is sitting and employing a wrong person, or we as a security agency and SAPS, we go and take the criminal outside of the department. I seriously, if ever then there's nothing you can do, you just tell them they do, otherwise then there's nothing else happens, and then we end up with kids that are dying. In this case of ESCOM, in particular SOEs and the whole supply chain management in departments, we end up with money going somewhere. And it's not because it's people that are not known. It's a person that gets removed, you remove a person from social development because of corruption, you vet that person. Then another minister takes that person to health. And when you get there with your vetting report, the person is excused, is getting employed in education. Yet the person has something hanging over their head according to your report. Can't we have something to remove those people? Isn't there a recourse, please?
I think, Minister, what we're trying to determine, as you say, that your work is anchored in law, therefore it's binding. I know in this country there's a big debate and big discussion about whether it's binding or whether recommendations or what. There's a big hoo-ha. Those are reports. Here we're speaking about the law, which should be adhered to. Because the one thing, colleagues, in my mind is maybe then we should be engaging the AG that the issue of vetting and screening should become an audit competence. And it should be reflected the extent to which departments and entities are complying with SSA reports. Because, I mean, seated here, my heart just breaks to say the honest truth, that the post office would have bypassed something which ended up with an innocent budding life taken away. I always make the point, my mother was a nurse and she used to say prevention is better than cure. And that's exactly what screening and the vetting does. It might not do it 100%, but it's an enabler of the process as part of the checks and balances we are building into the system to prevent, one, this tragedy, but also to push back on the frontiers of corruption, fraud, and malfeasance. So I think there is deep merit in the question that Honorable Lisa Nobimente raised, the binding effect. Where are the consequences when people do not comply? But I can't imagine how the post office would go and develop another process. Is there a process better than the SSA process? I mean, I don't want us to get sidetracked. I'm not really saying that the Union Emitters is sidetracking us. But it speaks to the heart of the problem, the compliance at ESCOM, 131 and only 31. So you've got literally 100 people at ESCOM who are saying to us, go jump off the nearest cliff. Where's the consequence? I think that's the issue. Does this bite, or is it a cosmetic exercise? I think that is what we need to tie down with. Then it will explain why we've had this problem for so long. We've had the SEPs here, and they were in sixes and sevens about vetting. The question is, maybe Minister will clarify us also, who initiates this vetting process? That is also important, because if you are going to sit and wait for departments and entities, that causes a problem, because then they can just choose not to. So unless it's made compulsory, then you're faced with a problem. So I think in light of if you can just tie it down on the binding effect and the process, and then we can, colleagues, then bring this to a conclusion, because I think we've gotten the explanations we wanted, which could contextualize the problem we are faced with in this particular space. Minister, we went to ESCOM, the committee, we've been there. And as Babusami was saying, we have observations of our own, which we've had the draft report, we're finalizing our report tomorrow into ESCOM. And some of the things you are saying we have seen as part of the challenges at ESCOM, and we're going to be making recommendations to that effect, including but not limited to the vetting of the board. That's part of it. But let's just tie down in law what we have expressed. Okay, sure. The minister's exercising her right to delegate.
Thanks, Minister. Thanks, Chairperson. Directly on to that question of recourse, there is a law that clearly states that clearance can be withdrawn. But again, we may want to indicate that we do have vetting regulations. Actually, if we go to slide number on page 7, the last one of reviewing the minimum information security standards, this is addressing the very same issue of recourse. Because the MIS, which is actually an old document also adopted since 2006, stipulates that the head of an institution has got the right, say in case of the post office, to say that this person is not suitable due to 1, 2, 3, 4 factors, but the head of an institution, according to the law, can say, I will take the risk. I need to do that. But we are saying, right, having experienced this, we have to review, as indicated on page 7, the very last sentence, that one of the interventions we need to do to mitigate against such factors will be to review the minimum information security standards so that it gives truth to the outcomes of vetting. Again, we do have the vetting regulations currently, which have been drafted in consultation with SAPS and Defence, which is actually now
pronouncing on punitive measures for non-compliance. So the vetting regulations are in that consultation processes. They are going to be presented to the JCPS principals and then to our operational command structure and then to the minister for approval. It is actually at an advanced stage.
If I get you correctly, then the recommendations or the findings are not binding.
They are binding. It is just that there is a clause that also says you as a chairperson, for an example, as the head of an institution, can say, I take a risk. Therefore, in case, in event that something happens, it means that head of an institution who has weighed
right.
the decision as allowed by the law.
Okay, did the minister just want to build on that?
Mr. Chairman, just quickly for the minister to answer, yes, that's where a vetting has been done and a recommendation made. But it seems to me that we're never getting to the point where the vetting is actually done in the first place. So it's not something that can be withdrawn.
Mr. Ross wants to build on that.
Yes, we have.
Noted Jubabson,
as we said earlier on, Honorable Member, we have done 48% of the vetting, and we have indicated, the problems that we encounter in the process. So it's not as if nothing has been done. Some work has been done, and it comes back to the issue of compliance and enforcement. Now, one of the first things I did when I got to the department was that we need to review the minimum information security standards document. We also, according to the high-level review panel report, we have to overhaul almost all of our legislation. That process is underway. Issues of dealing with consequences of non-compliance will be dealt with in there. So as much as the recommendations are binding, the enforcement of non-compliance always evades us. So we will then have to take away that part that gives them the discretion to implement or not to implement based on what might be termed as operational reasons. And by the way, we're looking at this much broader than what we're talking about here today. And I'll give you an example of the so-called xenophobic attacks. From 2006, with regards to the national security strategy, we had delivered or presented recommendations to cabinet, some of which have not been implemented, which could have helped us to stem the tide of violence against foreigners in our country, or the type of violence that we come across from time to time. Now, Cabinet must also make it a point that whatever recommendations that come through are implemented by monitoring and tracking their own decisions as Cabinet. But again, we need to put this in new legislation to say whatever it is that we recommend should be consequences for non-compliance of that. And I think this is where the gray area is.
Honorable Somia? Okay. Ma'am Tolash, I'll come to you. One point here, thank you very much. I think to the minister, it should be clear the fact that indeed they are here today because of the concern of lack of, and therefore we are fully in support of the fact that vetting must be done. Irrespective, where it matters most is on the decision lines. The recent allegations of a board member of SAE is an indication that decisions are made, and those decisions could carry substantive form of action, and they could lead into the loss of finances, which is our intention to safeguard all the time. And therefore, wherever it matters, it should be done. You see. Secondly, is the point that says when it's done, it's clear that it's a call of the
of various centers. It might be an SOE, a department, a municipality, and so on. So it's their call to yourselves that we would really need these kinds of officials to be vetted. So the prime mover of vetting in this instance might not be yourselves. You only implement the fact that these kinds of officials must be vetted. And the outcomes of that vetting process, are they justified? I'm getting into the sense that if indeed they're classified, the publication, so that we could as well open up to the fact that here the department is reneging to implement the results of its own call in terms of the vetting process, and therefore you would be found a bit hamstrung by the fact that the primary call has not been from your own side as the unit that seek to implement such vetting. So that is defeatist itself. Anyway, you do it, we fail to implement, we continue, and things happen, as it has been the case in this instance. You have highlighted a number of areas of challenge, which themselves are somewhat hefty, a refusal of an institution or part of an institution to observe that process. Is itself criminal? Take the primary example of ESCOM. 121 identified, 21 come forward, and that itself is a problem. It really keeps the country hamstrung in as far as the fight against the areas of corruption. And we provide money from fiscals, huge sums of money which ought to have gone somewhere else, and those individuals are responsible for such a kind of decision. And then there's refusal from the executive to do so. So while it's not your call, and you would really need to be assisted in terms of having some kind of a hold into these kinds of things going forward. So it's indicative that while we're scoper, we're looking into how rents and cents somewhat diminish and so forth, not used appropriately, and the requisite committees ought to carry this kind of a function in a substantive way. We'll make our own reference to such areas in terms of the outlook. I think, Chair, from myself, what is disheartening is the fact that even if it's not yourselves, I'll do my job and give it back to you, and you fail to implement. That's very heartening. It's a waste of money, waste of time, in terms of resources, and people fail to implement such. It's indeed criminal. So those are the kinds of things that at least we don't have to smile on. We need really to frown in such instances. The minister is here today. She's accounting on the very same thing, and she somewhat sacrificed her time. And this thing has to be done. People are failing to implement. And things continue, and if it's normal, it's not right.
Right, I'll come to you, Minister. Mam Dolash, then Honourable Mendel. Can you just note?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. In appreciation of the presentation by the Minister, but also support your recommendation that the AG's office must take this into consideration, that it becomes part of the auditing and there should be penalty. SCOPA, I think, would have been ahead of everybody on the next round of auditing. But Chair, I just want Minister to come back and be very clear and to say, when everything has been done, there's law that needs to be abided, and just somebody decides not to be part of that, as the official said, when the head of the institution decides not to, then for me, why should there be a law if there will be choices of some people not being liking it, to an extent not implementing? As Honorable asked earlier on, are there no consequences insofar as that matter is concerned? If there are none, why should there be a law that we could choose whether to abide by that law or not? It's going to make the work of the minister and his department, I'm sorry, very, very strenuous then. What is this that we should do to make sure that we fast track that and do away with that kind of an attitude? I don't think it should be accepted. I think we should say here and now, it's not going to be accepted. In fact, Chair, through your office, let's bring back the issue of the post office. At least we have information now. We are wondering where is the women's ministry insofar as this matter is concerned. Because with the GBV that is so rife, we should be able to find the reasons why we are in this predicament so that we can be able to find solutions there. The last one, Chief, is there by any chance a way to bring in municipalities? I'll tell you why. We have been embarking on a situation where we were had hearings with municipalities here, Minister, wherein during the work of both the department and those municipalities, there's a situation where some department officials are being loaded, offloaded from the department to municipalities. Because sometimes there are things that are behind those officials, then they are offloaded into those municipalities, either by through intervention, the section hundreds, and so on. But then the municipalities have to now receive those very important people as part of the staff because of the arrangements that at a distance you might not see, because all that is problematic. How do you come and intervene to assist and at the end to become part of what you came to come and assist? It's a problem. However, we're not discussing that now, but I would want to hear from the minister, how is this going to work in the municipalities? Because in that space, Chair, if we don't look at that space, we have more troubles than we can understand where we are sitting. As we have been meeting with them, the huge problems, where people are being allowed to move from one municipality to the other, because they are being alleged to be involved in the corruption. So they just skip the boat and go and join Mpumalanga, from Mpumalanga quickly to Northwest, and so on, without them being picked up. How is this going to assist with what the minister has been explaining? Thank you very much, Chief.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mente. And then we'll come to you, Minister.
Chair, now I'm shocked. You know, the current document on minimum information security standards is very scary. And I'm not sure if the comprehensive nature of review is in a scope where this whole document has to be strengthened much more than it is. If you take chapter 9 of it and 10, they are talking in two different angles. In 9, the screening authority, which is our high security standard, which we depend on, can merely make a recommendation. Merely. It's stipulated in a document. Therefore, whoever receives it can either use it or disregard it. And then I do not understand, how does that then speak to the chapter 10 of the Constitution? Because chapter 10 of the Constitution, number section 1951, is very clear in terms of the ethics and integrity. So if then our ethics and integrity depends on mere recommendations, we don't have a law, like Mam Tolashe said. It scraps the law altogether. It cuts it out. So there is fundamentally something wrong with how it was developed I'm not sure why it gave so much loopholes. Perhaps there is. I'm trying to think, Minister, where a situation I was in a different sector, where a situation where entry-level police officials, the students that must go to college, when they are found to have a criminal record on the first phase screening, the national commissioner can waive a shoplifting of a loaf of bread, can waive a shoplifting of common assault. But how deep then does it go? Perhaps it was because of such situations. If then that's the case, they should be listed. They will not be limited to whatever scope, but we cannot, in a case where a person who was found in an armed robbery, like the post office, it was armed robbery case, an armed robber, that's a very serious offense. You then come and service people in a post office where there is confidential documents you must be dealing with. Some of them are carrying valuable goods. You are an armed robber. You are going to deal with valuable goods in a post office, let alone to look further into the GBV, which then becomes an end result. But the scope of work and the environment we are going to be going to on its own does not require a person of that kind of a caliber. Therefore, I'm not sure, Minister, if the comprehension of the review and the complexities of it, this document is talking like this. There is a law, there's what you have to do, there's what the requesting department must do, and how long then can that take place, given the fact that earlier on you indicated, I remember, there is a letter we wrote about the standing committee not existing after you brought that up. And if then the committee for now is not even established, is it possible for you to do all these things without the committee within a short space of time? How long can it take for the reviewal of this particular document? Because even if we want to hold people accountable, Comrade Moyo, we are not going to. They are going to refuse to be vetted if this law is not in place. If it's like this, it stays itself. They can merely itself. Therefore, they can agree to vetting. They can refuse. Nothing will happen to them. So we need to talk to how long can you review this document? When can you finish it? We will deal as members of parliament with the establishment of the committee. I don't think that's in your hands, but we will deal with it at the platform that are proper to deal with the establishment of the committee. But do you have necessary human resource, required equipment or space or knowledge or legal service to deal with this, and how long can it take?
That minister may claim it. Let me finish with members so that you respond once. Mam Zibula.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think we need to get the clarification on the issue of union interference. Because those ones are the ones who speaks a lot about the issue of corruption. If they interfere in such a way that people mustn't be vetted, it's a problem. To me, it's a problem. Or they saying that because of what Member Dolashe has said, that we need to have the law. Everybody has to go according the law. But I don't see why the union must come and tell us that the vetting is a bad thing or whatever. To me, it's something else. But we have to look into it, Minister. It's very important.
Minister, just a few things on my side, and then colleagues, we can tie it down, because Ms. Shabalala is also on standby to give us, we ate into her time today. There's another session after this. Minister, I want to say we will make sure that ESCOM complies. There's no two ways about that. It's a non-negotiable. The risks involved at ESCOM are of a serious nature to national stability, economically, socially, and otherwise. So, as I said, we will be finalizing on the ESCOM report, but I think that that compliance will happen. And it does not come at your own insistence, it comes at our own observation. You have merely given us a perspective which we had not had. The fact that you've got 100 people or so who are not complying. Of course, your challenge insofar as budgeting is concerned is noted, but we will also, we can't be a player in the referee in this committee and plead for funds ahead of your duly established committees. I think we may merely just further express to Parliament the urgency of dealing with that matter, because it helps us here, the value chain of accountability. So it is important that Parliament moves with the necessary speed. The delay is no longer acceptable. So we will look into that so that we can deal with these issues. Minister, I hope that your department will work with the law enforcement agencies dealing with the Uyunene matter, because my issue is, if you're going to assume the risk, you should be part and parcel of those who will be in the dock, because there was forewarning. So assuming the risk comes with that particular risk, there's consequences, and the consequence is that now there has to be accountability. And so we hope that in one way or the other, the department will avail itself to provide that information to assist the case. How you do it will leave to your capable hands, but ours is to say it cannot be, because you see, we need to make an example out of people who do not comply or people who assume the risk. You cannot assume the risk in a vacuum. Assuming the risk means exactly that, that when things go south, having been forewarned, then something has got to give. So I hope that happens. Minister, we note that your review of MISS is going to, your estimated date is the 30th of September 2020, and as you have said, we must hold you accountable to that. We most certainly will, because it is fundamentally clear, colleagues, that one of the challenges we have is that unraveling the realities of state of capture and pushing back on corruption, that it's going to take a while, because obviously here you're dealing with an entrenched system where, and the SSA was not immune to that particular reality. So we will give you the space and time, and I'm sure the relevant but we will, I'm sure, as a committee, want quarterly reports on progress. So we will not hold you to an outer date. We will want to check how far those things are going, insofar as all the things that you have put here, the approval and implementation of the INVS, 31 March, the fast-tracking of the e-vetting solution at pilot phase, 30 September 2020, and the collaboration with Organ of State, September 2020, and the review of the MISS 2020. So we'll want to, at the finalization of our report of this meeting, the observations, I'm sure we will take that particular one forward. The issue of the municipalities minister, I think, will at some point have to interact with us and the PC on COCTA. Particularly the vetting of, as you know, the troubled municipalities, for example, who are under Section 139. You've got administrators who assume a lot of powers. So that's one first point of call. You're dealing with municipal managers, CFOs, and so on. So we will look at that, I think, colleagues, when we finalize our reports into the municipalities. The ministry can have a look at what you are saying. Colleagues, we're dealing with rands and cents. I want to add another one today that I think must become part of our mantra. Rands, cents, and people. Because they are the ones who are the conveyor belt upon which money flows. And part of that is ensuring that the right people are in positions and they are fit for purpose. Finally, Minister, please express to Cabinet that if you're going to have a memo and a directive, it must be coupled with a budget. This is a 2014 Cabinet resolution. There's 2006. We can't be issuing memorandums and decisions in a vacuum. Let's cost these things and make sure that it actually there's meaning to it. Let's not tick the boxes. So we will, I'm sure colleagues, I will recommend to you as well that insofar as this recommendation is concerned, insofar as vetting is concerned, we need to take it back to Cabinet and say to them, right, you wanted this done because this was not at our insistence. All we did, we were holding Cabinet accountable to its own commitments and committed to its own commitments. What was the plan? So I think we need to take it back there for it to receive the necessary executive support and exert the authority. Because SSA is a recipient of a Cabinet decision. If we are saying let's go to the genesis of decisions, let's make an example out of this one. So, Cabinet, you have decided that this must happen because if there's no checks and balance, then we will be forever churning resolutions. It will be and so on. So, Minister, in our next engagement, we will also want to see an improvement in that 48%, and we'd want to know where further who the problem children are who don't want to be vetted. I'm sure it's not just Eskom. Want a full list so that we can call them here and for them to explain themselves. Because at some point we must, and that point is even yesterday, is that if you refuse to be vetted, particularly under this climate, then shape up or ship out. Allow those who are prepared to subject themselves to process to take the space. So, Minister, I will hand over to you to make your concluding remarks. And have the responses to the issues that have been raised, and then colleagues will tie it down at that point. We will take it further in our own engagement, and then Mr. Walala and Mr. Sege, so please get ready to, when we finish, you will immediately take the hot seat and give us the breakdown and analysis of the audit outcomes. So we will immediately shoot into that. Mr. Somi, I see you are itching to say something. So
very small matter, Chair. In my other capacity.
Okay, I will not exercise my dictator, democratic dictator.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you. I'm very sorry for it.
No, go for it.
Yeah. There's a whole slide at page 4, which is indicative of the fact that it's not only the minister's responsibility. Through the need, there was engagement of the Minister of Finance at the time. There was engagement of the Auditor General at the time. So why the fuss? You know? Why the fuss? Where is money to deal with this kind of work? You know? And that kind of a slide is giving us a background to SCM vetting project, as a project itself. So what is the fuss? Yeah. If ministers themselves committed themselves into this kind of a project.
I think in our next
I think we must hold them responsible.
I think in our next engagement, we will probably have to get Treasury here and the AG so that they can... and I think, yeah, so let's, Tommy, can we note that so that we broaden the scope? Otherwise, we will not be able to turn down. And of course, there's the issue of the unions, which I think is important for us to understand the extent and aspect to which interference arises so that we can have a full understanding to them. Minister, over to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think a lot of that which has been raised in the committee has been very helpful, but it's issues that we would like to take to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. And we would really request that Parliament speeds up the process, because I am one person that is really itching to go to that, to go to the JSCI for a variety of reasons. I arrived in the department, I think it was in May, June, in May, and I raised the matter of the mess. To date, I've not received anything from the department with regards to a progress update on where MES is. Now, when you go to issues like that, it's almost like you're micromanaging people, but you have a political responsibility to ensure that a department operates. Even if legislation before you, policies or regulations before you, do not give you the type of responsibility that you want, there are innovative ways of doing things. And I think it's not just the SSA that lacks that. I think in all departments, we lack that innovation to ensure that things happen. For example, one of the things that I raised when I spoke to the department about the issue of NIS was to say, in the interim, look at the Public Service Act, look at the Public Administration Management Act. The PAM Act, the Department of Public Service and Administration, is still in the process of developing regulations. Ride on that and ensure that some of the things that we want to see are also captured in those regulations. I can guarantee you there has been no meeting with the DPSA on the matter. I might be wrong, but I can almost guarantee you that. But all I'm just saying is that it's not just SSA. It's government in general. We do not use other legislation that is before us to enforce certain things. And I will read this to you, because I was the Minister of Public Service and Administration at some point, and I had maximum power that I too did not fully utilize. One of which is Section 3H, Integrity, Ethics, Conduct, and Anti-Corruption in the Public Service. That's a great responsibility. But the same minister also, and I'm not talking about Comrade Selzo Mkhono, I'm talking about the Minister of Public Service, because I too did not fully utilize the powers that the Public Service Act gives me, that I can ask for any documentation as a Minister of Public Service of any minister and of any DG. And non-compliance, it says here, any employee who willfully or grossly negligent manner fails to furnish documents or information as contemplated in subsection 1, shall be guilty of an offense and shall be liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 12 months. Now I'm saying that there is legislation. If we don't have the muscle and the clout for enforcing compliance, we can always ride on what the Public Service Act says and the PAM Act says, because they have the responsibility of employment. They are the custodians of the act that regulates the employment of people in the public service. They have the responsibility to establish the anti-corruption and anti-ethics unit, which, amongst others, has a responsibility to identify systematic weaknesses in the system and recurring risks. So they have that responsibility. Who do they work with, or who do we work with to ensure enforcement? It is them. But again, have we gone to them? I've raised these things, what is about not? I've raised these things. Have we gone to the DPSA to talk to them about this, to ask them that whilst we are working on overhauling our own pieces of legislation and systems, can we write on your processes to ensure that this is captured in regulation, which is going to be faster than the process that we are undertaking? I can go on and on and on. On Chapter 6 of the Public Administration Management Act, Section 4D, E, and F can help us tremendously as a department. But again, do we look at what other departments can do to assist? And it's not the problem only of SSA. It's government in general. We have a silo way of dealing with issues, that where we see that we can use that piece of legislation for the objectives that we intend to derive from a particular activity, we do not even do that. And all I'm just saying here, Chairperson, is that we will go back to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence on all of the issues that Honorable Musheng and Honorable Mentor raised, to take them back to the JSCI to say, let us deliberate over these issues. We have the high-level panel review report that we need to implement. But the implementation of that speaks to new legislation. We are already in the month of
October.
The year, financial year ends on the 30th of March. The processes of Parliament in themselves are not going to allow for us to put something in today and it goes through the process tomorrow, when we still have to go for your public hearing. So the pace at which we move at the SSA is also a problem. And when you push people, it's almost like you're micromanaging them. But I would like for us to work in a manner that says there is urgency. We cannot afford to postpone things that we can do today for tomorrow. Because what that means is that it affects the integrity of our country, it affects the lives of our people, it affects our economy. The list is endless. Basically, when you look at it, this government rests on the shoulders of state security for it to be able to deliver services to its people. Thank you very much.
All right. Minister, thank you very much. In our next engagement, maybe let me conclude by saying that even INJ, as an ordinary man in the street, as Mazambane has said, can immediately tell you that I'm bound to be concerned if in Vuani some 30 schools get burnt. I ask myself, where's SSA? I mean, it's one school I can understand, two schools maybe. When it comes to three, and I'm bound to raise eyebrows. These flare-ups, the violence that was directed at foreign nationals, it speaks to shortcomings, it speaks to weaknesses and borders on failure, if not being failure. So it's not acceptable. And the pace at which vetting is going on and so on is of concern to us. So whilst we understand your challenges, we sit here and we remain not satisfied. And the department must make sure that it deals with these things as a matter of urgency. And we will most definitely within probably try by the end of this term of Parliament have put through our report, which will have binding recommendations. And we will hold you accountable to them because the one thing that we don't want to do is also be, in the truest sense of the word, be a watchdog. We want to be a bite dog. So the appetite is there. We are hungry. We will bite. So the department must actually shape up. Inspector General Sobonan, that's just how it is. That's how the cookie crumbles. The committee has adopted an attitude which says, we've got no friends. So today was a preliminary meeting for us to understand your space. Having gotten insight into it, we will limit ourselves to that which is our competence as public accounts, and the rest of the things, of course, correctly and procedure must go to the JSCI, which is the Parliament's responsible body. Do expect from time to time invitations from us, correspondence from us on matters related to public accounts. So, Minister and delegation, we want to thank you very much for being here, and we will probably interact in the near future. If there's anything that arises on your side, we've got an open door policy, 24/7, 365. On that note, sibonga kakhulu. Right, colleagues, ayikhi comfort break, ne? Noma ngiyayifona. I'm a benevolent dictator, all right. 5 minute comfort break. Right, 5 minute comfort break, and then
page 31 on the next chapter, education. on unauthorized expenditure. The department doesn't have unauthorized expenditure for the current year, but it's got accumulation or what is it, balance of unauthorized, which comes from the previous financial year. And then on irregular expenditure, the department has got 208.5 million irregular expenditure for 2018-2019, and then the total balance, the accumulation, which means it's still a human experience that has not been condoned or seen the financial. It's 1.8 billion for the Department of Education. And then fruitless and wasteful expenditure is 867,000 for the current year. And then the total is 2.1 million. And then this, there's also a column on the budget that is received by the department, the actual expenditure, as well as the under or over expenditure. So this department has underspent, so there's money that is being rolled over. So it's 998.8% expenditure. And then also these are the two entities, the Malusi and the Council of Educators. We go to the Department of Environmental Affairs and its entities. The Department of Environmental Affairs received and access opinion for the past for 2017, 2018, and then this year it received a qualification. So we can say it has improved, but still the qualification, but at least it's not an adverse finding. And then the Auditor General identified findings on evidence, mostly on evidence to evidence for to substantiate the amount that has closed in the annual financial statement. This department has also got irregular expenditure. It has underspent significantly on its budget. It's got material impairment. There's also findings on performance information, which is called predetermined objectives. Then if we also go to the page 31, we can see unauthorized expenditure. The department doesn't have unauthorized expenditure. It doesn't have for the current year, as well as the accumulation estimated amount. The irregular expenditure is for 772 million, and then the accumulation is 150. Fruitless and wasteful expenditure is 3 million, and then the total fruitless and wasteful expenditure is 11 million, and then the department has spent 90.7% of its total budget, but it has not achieved some of its performance information as for the presentation. There's also information on about five of the department entities. Most of them are unqualified findings, and the findings have been explained in the document. But I think the one that is two of the departments that are qualified is South African National Biodiversity Institute, which received a qualified audit opinion, as well as the South African Weather Services, which received a qualified audit opinion. The findings for SANAP, irregular expenditure, revenue from exchange transactions where there's no evidence provided for to the auditors, the statement of corresponding figures, and as well as expenditure in contract management. And then there's an attachment where it tells it provides information on the on page 35. Where it gives information on the irregular expenditure that has been kept by the department. Okay.
So we won't read the page numbers for you.
Okay. The word assessment is also a qualification from two unqualified audit findings. So it has been addressed. Auditor General identified PP property, plant, and equipment have been overstated. The intangible assets, they have not been correctly accounted for. The department has got commitment also of 6.4 million. The other entities, I'm not going to go through them because they are the unqualified. But the information is here, as well as in the attachment. The Department of Health and its entities. The Department of Health has received unqualified audit opinion and findings for between financial years. $24.8 million. balance of fruitless and wastefulness went to 11.9. So it means some of them, fruitless and wastefulness, which are written off by the department during the financial year. And the department spent 99.8% of the budget. Under fruitless and wasteful expenditure, the members will notice there are footnotes that have been mentioned. In those cases where you find that the sum of the fruitless and wasteful expenditure is recovered during the financial year, but it relates to the prior year. So I just made a note where fruitless and wasteful expenditure or irregular expenditure has been recovered during the year, but it relates to current. The entities that receive qualified, one entity that falls in this portfolio, the National Student Aid Scheme, didn't table the annual report and under administration, so I just mentioned it, but the previous year it received qualified. Another entity that received qualified is NSF National Skills Fund, and the findings are accruals and observables, and also the irregular expenditure and progress and with the expenditure in the department in the administration. Okay. DERCO, Department of International Relations and Cooperation. This department has got only one entity, which is the African Union and International Cooperation. Therefore, this unqualified audit findings in 2017. So for the past two financial years, it received qualified audit outcome. And then qualifications were on movable, tangible assets, had issues with their asset register, especially the missions of the assets on the internet of other countries. It's got findings also on cash and cash equivalent, inadequate control to manage foreign cash on hand, irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, as well as expenditure on unoccupied state-owned properties. AG also identified weaknesses in the general control. So I'm just going to go to their call and international relations. They spent 97.2% of their budget. They didn't have unauthorized expenditure for the current year, but they unauthorized expenditure of 416 million in their balance sheet. The irregular expenditure is 298 million, but it includes irregular expenditure that relates to current, to prior years, but as the fact is covered during the 2018-19 financial year. And the total irregular expenditure in the book is 1.5 million. Yeah. And then progress and wasteful expenditure is 101.9 million. The total progress and wasteful expenditure is 11.8 million. And then the entity, the other entity, which is the IRF, receives unqualified budget with no findings. So, Department of Labor received unqualified audit findings for three financial years, but there were findings on understanding of the budget goals, the planned targets not achieved, expenditure management, which includes the regular and progress and additional expenditure, internal control deficiencies, especially in financial monitoring. If you go to the extra weight of all the irregular and unauthorized expenditure that we need to expenditure, the department didn't incur any unauthorized expenditures over the year under the two, and there's also nothing on the balance sheet. Fruitless, the expenditure is $3.4 million. Fruitless and wasteful expenditure is $4.4 million. The total is $8.6 million. And the department spent $94.4 million. The total is $8.6 million. And then most of the entities within this portfolio have received unqualified audit findings. Unqualified audits would find that two, $2 million, the balance of the expenditure is $1.1 million, Fruitless and Wasteful has spent like 110 million, the balance is 199 million. And the department spent 99% of this budget. And most entities in this portfolio received unqualified audit to find the there was also NEXA. They didn't take off their annual report for 2018-2019. National Treasury entities. For National Treasury, I will just deal with the department and staff. The other entities, they've received, most of them received unqualified with no findings, but the rest are with findings. The department has been receiving unqualified audits with findings for the past three financial years. The findings were on the regular expenditure, goodless and wasteful expenditure, findings on performance information. On predetermined objectives, there's also internal control efficiency. If you go to National Treasury, the Department of National Treasury, they didn't have unauthorized expenditure for 2018-19. Also, there's nothing on the balance sheet on unauthorized expenditure. But for irregular expenditure, the department has 465.9 million irregular expenditure for 2018-19, and then the balance that is waiting for to be confirmed or to be recovered is 587.6 million. The regular expenditure is 67.6 million, and the total of fruitless and regular expenditure is 201.2 million, and the department spent 96.4 of this budget. Staff have received unqualified findings unqualified audit findings for the past 3 years. The findings were on procurement and procurement and contract management, the regular expenditure, internal control efficiency, and the details of the regular expenditure as well as process and regular expenditure included in our next chapter. For irregular expenditure, staff we had 254.3 million for 2018-19, and the balance is 356. For irregular, for fruitless and wasteful expenditure, it incurred 14.1 million findings, and there's also DPP, Council for Health and Environmental Services, unqualified funding, unqualified office with no funding. The IGT has received qualified funding from Asia, and the qualification, qualification that has been and also IGT and also in the attachment details of its also making losses in terms of making losses in the past two financial years. Also irregular expenditure of 30.2 million for the current year and 82.7 million for the accumulated amount. Project and municipal expenditure of 408,000 and 46.2 million. Department of Tourism has got one entity, which is the South African Tourism. The department itself has received an unqualified audit finding for 2018. For 2017, it received unqualified audit finding. And then for 2018-19, which is the current financial year, and which received qualified opinion. So this department has been correct in the present. Because for 2016-2017, it was clean, clean audit, and then it received unqualified finding, and then received the qualification in 2018-19. So the findings on provable, tangible assets, the AGM says the asset register is not reliable, because most of the assets could not be properly accounted for. But through that and basically expenditure, statement of corresponding figures, material adjustments, the financial information, and procurement and contract management. The department, if you go to the NHL, unauthorized expenditure, and complex and wasteful expenditure, if it's better expenditure. The department doesn't have any unauthorized expenditure. Irregular expenditure of 26.5 million for the current year, and it's still waiting to be condoned. The profit and wasteful expenditure is 6.3 million. The total profit and wasteful expenditure that is waiting to be written off or recovered is 109.8 million. And the department spent 98.8. The department has got one entity, South African Tourism, and this entity has received unqualified audit findings. And the same is true for South African Tourism regular expenditure is also included in the annexure. The Department of Trade and Trading also received unqualified with no findings, and most of the entities within this department have received unqualified findings. Unqualified was no findings. Same is the Department of Economic Development. And I think this was the next one. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to go through the words, but the details for irregular expenditure are in the next chapter. The Department of Transport and these entities, I think in the, some of the entities for transport, they talk about Department of Transport and for five of these entities, I'll cover it in the department itself has received unqualified audit audit opinion with findings for the past three financial years. The findings were on irregular expenditure, non-compliance with legislation, procurement and contract management, as well as expenditure management, also internal control deficiencies, leadership, financial and performance management. And then if you go to the annexure on irregular expenditure, forget the business expenditure. The department spent 98.9% of his budget for unauthorized expenditure. $998,000 for the current year, and then $1.3 million calculated amount in the balance sheet, and then the irregular expenditure is $107.2 million for 2018-19, which includes irregular expenditure for prior years that will come into the current financial year. And then the total of the irregular expenditure is $746.1 million. Wasteful expenditure is $119,000 for 2018-19, and the total is $151,000. And most of the entities have received unqualified or received binding. Most of these are in the expenditure of components for the cover in the financial. And then also
Honorable members, I will take you through the financial performance of SOD. The way we approached the annual report in this current year is a little bit different from what we did in previous years. Dando has done group one. I will do the SOEs. I'm still busy with the departments and entities which fall under group two. So that report will be ready sometime next week. But it is not ready currently. The reason why I decided to do SOEs separately from the department is because of the information which was out in the meeting. They were doing their own assessment of the SOEs. So I decided that maybe I must just go through all the annual reports so that we have all the facts regarding performance of the SOEs. So what I did is I looked at 11 SOEs, or we may call them SOCs, because they are state-owned companies. On table one, which is on page 4 of the document, it shows the financial performance for the past 3 years. So it looks at 2017-18, and also the current year, which is 2018-19. On the last column, what I did is, if the AG raises going concern issue, I indicated on the last column. And if members look at table one, you can see that there are issues on the going concern which were raised for almost all SOEs, except AMSCO and CASA. So it really shows that there is a problem when we consider the future of SOE. In most cases, the liabilities are more than assets. So it creates an impression that in the future, we might have problems regarding the financial viability of SOE. On table one, it also shows that there are two SOEs that have not tabled for the past 3 years. It is SAA and SAA Express. So since 2016-17, there has been no annual report of these two entities. And in the current year, Alexco has also not tabled. We are still waiting for their annual report. And in most cases, they submit their annual report very late, but they do table. There is also an annexure, which is on the last page, which is page 13. The annexure looks at the profits and losses, which were experienced in 2017-18. It also looks at the profits and losses in the current year, and focuses on irregular expenditure as well as fruitless expenditure. If we take example, if we take ESCOM, there are details on page 5 on what issues the AG has found at ESCOM. So for the past 3 years, ESCOM has received a qualified audit. and the AG has raised concerns relating to irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Eskom incurred irregular expenditure of 25.7 billion in this current year. So what is in their annual financial statements is that the irregular expenditure is 25.7 billion and it was 21 billion in 2018. There are also issues of non-compliance with legislation which was raised by the AG. There are material losses of 1.7 billion which take place due to meter tampering and also illegal connection. So it means in this current year alone, 1.7 billion was lost due to illegal connections of electricity. Another issue which was raised by the AG is steps are not taken in all instances to collect revenue. In as much as Eskom has issues regarding future sustainability, they do not collect all revenue. Currently, we know the issues of municipalities which are not paying Eskom, and that is lost revenue. And also the AG says effective and appropriate steps are not taken to prevent irregular and fruitless expenditure. They also do not take disciplinary steps against officials who incur irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure. The AG also flagged issues of supporting documents not being available. Sometimes even minutes of board meetings are not available. So it is not easy to find out what resolution has been taken by the board. Okay, I've spoken to irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And if we go to Annexure A, which is on page 13, Eskom experienced losses of 2.3 billion last year. In the current year, there is a significant increase to 20.7 billion. So that is a loss in 1 year. Their irregular expenditure is 6.6 billion, and the accumulated figure, which has not been condoned, is 25.6 billion. Their fruitless and wasteful expenditure is 641 million and the accumulated figure is 560. This shows the significance of what is happening in our society. The second SOE that we have dealt with is the SABC. They have issues relating to property, plant and equipment as well as irregular expenditure. So in their irregular expenditure in the current year, it's 336.2 million and their accumulated figure is 5.2 billion. The reason for having such a significant amount of irregular expenditure, it means it is not condoned because there are no investigations taking place. Because if investigations are taking place, that irregular expenditure is supposed to be condoned. The SABC also made losses of 482 million, million in the current year. Janel made losses of 1.7 billion. Their irregular as well as fruitless expenditure is 216.7 million and 139 million. Now this is a significant figure if members take into consideration that this is fruitless and wasteful. So there has been no value which has been derived from an amount of 139 million. Alex Core, there is no information because the annual report has not been published. Then if we look at Transnet, Transnet had a profit of 12.2 billion last year. In this current year, they incurred a loss of 11.9 billion. So you can see the difference in just 1 year. Last year, there was a profit. In the current year, there is a loss. And it's not just a small loss, it's a significant loss of 11.9 billion. Their irregular expenditure is 49.9 billion, and the reason why they inherit such a big amount is because of the local contract with Swakumbe or something. Okay. I'll go to Transnet on page 8. It shows that there was a locomotive contract that they entered into in 2015. It only appears in the current year because the investigation has been finalized. So that's why there is that significant amount of 41.5 billion of irregular expenditure. So the accumulated amount is 58 billion in the current year. If we go to the post office had a loss of 1.2 billion last year. In the current year, it's still 1.1 billion. Their irregular expenditure is 182, and the total amount is 1.2 billion. AMSCO made a loss last year of 10.1 million. This year they made a profit. That is the only improvement in the SOG. Although they have irregular as well as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Transa, which is the last SOG I will deal with, although there are no issues which were raised regarding the going concern issue, but there are significant issues which were raised by the AG. Transa made a profit of 1.4 billion last year. This year they made a loss of 1.7 billion. So it is also a significant amount. Their irregular expenditure is 3 billion and the accumulated amount is 27.3 billion. Their fruitless and wasteful expenditure is 41 million. And their fruitless and wasteful expenditure, the accumulated amount stands at 383 million. So these are some of the issues I picked up on the SOC. On departments in group two, there are two departments which have not tabled their annual reports in the committee this current year. It is water affairs and culture. So we are still waiting for their annual report.
Colleagues, I think that was for us to get a sense of what lies ahead of us. I'm doubtful that the question is that the AG will speak to these details next week. That's what it is. So this is to enable us to prepare for the engagement.
Please forgive me for my ignorance. What then happens when the SPD president comes here?
We are calling them, they will be appearing. We call them whether the non-submitters are coming 28 on the 30th. So all those that have not submitted will be appearing before us on the 30th.
Because
we can't appear on the date of hearing. We'll find the determination.
I'll also apply my mind to
Chairman, just a quick one on that one. I mean, the law has, the company that has all sorts of consequences, but someone's got to initiate them. So our dear friend Dudu Mieni is in the process of being barred from being a director in any company because Archie has taken her on. So it does require that sort of thing, but there are consequences to it. So from a scope of point of view, you know, you have to apply your mind. I want to thank the two ladies for the preparation work and the preparation. Thank you very much for all that.
Chair, I think on the program we have allocated one day for the non-submission department. There are two main.
Some have written to the speaker and indicated date according to submission. So some will submit by the 31st of October. So we are not calling those ones. We are calling the open-ended.
How many?
I'll do a check of that. But also you're not going to get much. Why haven't you submitted?
If we take too many of them, we are not going to be able to deal with the patient.
I think it's SAP, and the staff,
a follow-up chain, on this one that has written to the requested minister to put signature for the nasty period. What then becomes the ones that will receive letters of them asking for extension, that period of nasty that gave us such a time. And then ministers fight on their behalf.
Ministers who?
The ministers are the ones that submit to the speaker and say, my department is saying it was in this particular moment. But I don't know. I know it's because of the money bills or whatever law that guides them in terms of accountability. But I don't think it's proper. Why would a minister be sending in for an official who did not do their work? That's what puzzles me a lot, that ministers are the ones that are signatures on this extension letter. There is no teacher.
And the annual reports are submitted to ministers by teachers. And the minister was submitted here. We'll look at that, but it's my understanding that's the process. And this table here, ours is to then do the checklist of who is submitted. The ministers who have not received anything must indicate that, look, I've not received anything to the speaker. And then, obviously, during the tracking, we picked those up. So I think the ones whom we are calling is Copter, Water Sanitation, SIS Press, SAA, Alexco, and NSS. Those are the ones who are. I think Copter, we must have double check that they are, Water Sanitation, they are delivered to. But the other one, therefore, there's no specified date. Others are thinking about submission next year. They are. So those are the only ones we are calling. Because the other, like you look at the National Disaster Management Center for Development, that arise because of COVID. So we start there, and then so I think that
that's exactly why I am at home. I get that the process goes through until the minister, but then the minister is a prerogative of saying, nah, fine, it's my official, let me ask for an extension. There isn't actually a consequence for that person asking an extension. They have the space that they play in, and now let me just ask my minister, and if I cannot account it fine, I'll ask my minister, 6 months later I'll come and do it. That's why I have a problem. Why are ministers finding it so easy for them not to at least first expose this useless wire and then take over with an action? How do you just ask for an extension and we're not even explained of what the problem, what were the consequences? Like that space for me is very problematic.
That's true. Let's get the minister here and the accountant here.
Why?
And then we will listen to their explanations, quote unquote, and then make determination of the communication. And Babson, then Mount Nash will be the last one.
No, sure. I think you have come up with me. Okay. These questions which I have must go straight to them. So you should tell us why are they somewhat given such a form. And then through such a response would be if given some sort of measure that would be proposed to Parliament. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Yes, please, Chair, I can imagine under the extreme situations where the minister won't be charged. What do we do? I guess that is my point. Are we not allowed to do this? Until you are ready within the time frame of government, until you are available with the minister, whatever you are not available within our timeline, we will not do this. Maybe it's a problem. But I think we must begin to consider so that we stop
correspondence has already gone to the ministers. Maybe what I can, at the point of emphasis, will write to the head of government to emphasize the need for ministers to be here. But let us maybe cross the fingers, let's not preempt because if we preserve our ammunition now, so let's, as far as we are concerned, ministers and accounting officers or persons will be expected to be here on the 30th of October. So it's a simple instance. And we will cross the bridge when we get to the colleague. Tomorrow, or double cross the bridge. Colleagues, tomorrow is SIU and NCA in this venue at 10 and 9. Tomorrow is 9 o'clock, colleagues.